Hello and thank you for joining me on this Brunel Questions podcast. My name is Ben Moxey, and during the show you'll also hear my co-host Alex Mitchell. Coming up over the next half an hour, you'll hear our interview with Loz Kay that was recorded on the 3rd of March 2011. Hello, good morning, and welcome to another edition of Brunel Questions. This time, Brunel Questions Loz Kay, who's the leader of the UK Pirate Party. Very first thing, could you explain to listeners at home, wherever they may be listening, the main idea behind your party?
Well, fantastic. It's great to be here this morning. Essentially, Pirate Party UK is the first genuinely 21st century political movement. We're here to defend freedom on the internet. We're here to stand up for civil liberties. We're against censorship and against abuses of freedom of speech. And we're here to reform intellectual property law. And we're basically the only party with a coherent digital policy. We're inspired by the success of the Swedish Pirate Party. That's where the movement began, essentially. Came out of the free software movement and file sharing movement, but they've ended up having two MEPs, and essentially we've grown into a movement that now spans the entire globe with 41 different pirate parties worldwide.
Yeah, I just sort of wanted to come in here and just talk about the name, because I know it's an issue that's interesting to some. Sort of when they hear Pirate Party, I mean, I know when I've been discussing, we've been having this interview this week, a few people have been saying to us, you know, maybe is, they sort of see pirate and they sort of think, is it a bit of a joke sort of name? You know, they think Monster Raving Loonies, is it sort of on those sorts of lines? How do you sort of address it? Difficulty?
Yeah, well, there's two things about the name. Well, this is something I get asked a lot. Well, the first thing is the good old joke thing. We had our party conference this just weekend, and Rick, who was the founder of the Swedish Pirate Party, was there. And one of the things that he said is that if we'd called ourselves something turgid like the Net Freedom Party or the, you know, that kind of thing, it would have remained an obscure web page that no one would have visited. And it certainly wouldn't have grown to a kind of worldwide movement for freedom of the internet. I think what happens is that actually once people have that initial kind of moment saying, well, okay, what is this? They certainly remember who we are. There's another kind of side to it, which is also that when people kind of hear what our kind of core area is about, this area particularly to do with freedom of the internet, and that we want to reform kind of copyright, people start associating us with this whole idea of a kind of piracy as something bad. We've always said we're actually proud to kind of stand up, and when the United States stops using terms like piracy in international treaties, perhaps then we'll think about a name change, but not until then. It's them that's using it, it's not us. You know?
It's a memorable name, I think. There are three core policies from your website. One is to end the excessive surveillance via CCTV and various different things like that that sort of councils and governments use to look after or look onto us. Do you think this is a vital policy? Do you think this is a great thing for freedom of speech? I mean,
well, particularly in terms of surveillance, again, it's another area where the mainstream parties actually have had nothing to say and no coherent policy. So that's why we've pushed this forward, particularly in the area of CCTV. The United Kingdom remains one of the most monitored countries in the entire world. There are all sorts. It's actually difficult to come across statistics because actually it's actually quite hard to get hold of. But for example, there are more CCTV cameras on Shetland that are controlled by the entire San Francisco police department. So to me, that says that we've actually gone too far. There's two things about it, really. It's not actually a terribly effective way of either of tracking down criminals or indeed crime prevention. Even the Home Office acknowledges that. And we've wasted a huge amount of money. Birmingham councils over the last 3 years has spent over £10 million on CCTV cameras. But also we've see how it can be an infringement of people's civil liberties, particularly in Birmingham, and entire areas which are predominantly Muslim areas of the town were actually entirely ringed by CCTV cameras with number plate recognition software put into it. Thankfully, this has been stopped now, but now we've wasted a huge amount of money and also undermined community relations.
Mm. I mean, would you not say that some of the surveillance, obviously, there's a certain amount of surveillance that is necessary? If you look at, we're not told all of the successful business surveillance, but for example, the 21st of July bomb plots.
Well, we're not against CCTV per se, but what we're warning is that we're seeing a very unfortunate slip towards the erosion of civil liberties, and that there seems to be very few mechanisms for us to get back our freedoms, and that increasingly, once we go down a route of surveillance, that we start to see actually more extreme measures being brought in. In Manchester, where I live, I've even been out with my mates at night, and suddenly I've been confronted with the type of metal detecting arches you expect to see in an airport. So what we're saying is that we need to stop and think.
Okay. There's also a call for real free speech. Mm-hmm. Can you define real? This is where I think everyone would agree free speech.
Yes.
Well,
essentially what it is, it's about, again, putting that on the agenda. We're seeing that different types of policies, for example, the Communications Act, actually brings in real problems about what we are allowed to say and also how we're allowed to do it. There's a very concrete example that we've just had over the last year. It's the so-called Twitter joke trial. Little backstory for anyone who doesn't know: Paul Chambers tweeted a joke just on his to his girlfriend on Twitter when Robin Hood Airport was closed. He just tweeted, "Crap, Robin Hood Airport is closed. They better get their together." I think I can say on radio. Otherwise, I'll blow the airport sky high. The police turned up to his place of work, actually prompted by this tweet, and arrested him in front of his colleagues and confiscated his laptop. We're not saying that we're in the kind of same situation that we are in the Middle East, but again, that there are concrete examples. We've seen that our freedom of speech is being undermined, and also police time is being wasted. I actually really feel for the coppers who were sent off to deal with Paul Chambers, because it's really a poor use of our resources and their time.
I mean, we've had an argument in Brunel Media itself recently, and that they come out of that would say, some people would say that there is no speech that is free. It all depends on who's paying for it. Certainly in the press, for example, and to throw a name in there, say the Sun newspaper, your speech is free as long as you don't criticise Rupert Murdoch. And what would you sort of say to that?
Well, that's why we think that, for example, issues like net neutrality are very important, and that the internet gives us an unprecedented possibility for free speech. What I mean by net neutrality is that essentially that all types of communication are given equal weight. The internet is allowing us a possibility to be able to reach people in a very different way, and that actually we're not coming through these channels like News International. And it's that's what we're here to defend.
Okay. Finally, also on the policies branch of it, parties also called for reformation of the copyright laws to allow for file sharing and to reduce sort of the length of the copywriter's protection. You yourself are a musician, composer. What really drove you to this idea? This sort of seems against almost your brethren.
Right, yes. I'm often asked this as a musician, are you not a kind of gamekeeper turned poacher? But for me, as a musician, I think the Pirate Party is the most logical place to be as a creative person. The Pirate Party UK puts creative policy, culture, right at the heart of its programme, because this is what we see as the way out of the kind of mess that we're in at the moment, in terms of growth and in terms of the economy. It sure isn't going to be manufacturing, and I think we've seen what financial services can do to the economy. So we're actually saying by allowing for collaboration and innovation, this is the way forward. One of the things that we particularly stand for is that we want to see reformation of things like digital rights management and also global locking of content. It's actually things like global locking of content which drives people to piracy. All the time I'm contacted by people saying, you know, I just really wanted to watch a Japanese animated tonight together with my children. I went onto iTunes, couldn't get it because it was only available in the United States, and then I went straight on to Pirate Bay and I can download it. Actually, what we're saying is that really, far from harming content providers, we're providing a way forward to actually really reach music fans, film fans, and actually cutting out the middle people, which we don't need anymore.
Okay, so just to sort of follow on from that, how would you propose then, say, that, you know, sort of some of the bigger artists that make a lot of their money out of their music, how would you propose they would still make their money? You know, what would they do? Would you have it sort of like people can pay what they want to buy their songs, or how'd you propose it?
Well, one of the big fallacies that's put around by the music industry bodies like the BPI is that there is some huge crisis. The fact is that there is not, even according to their own figures. The digital album sales have gone up over a third over the last year. Since 2006, single sales have hugely spiked, almost doubling. Yes, individual CD sales are dropping. Mm. But this is more than made up for by other sales. Last year, in 2010, there have been never so many units of music sold in the entire history of recording. There is not a crisis. And in any case, the selling of recordings has always been a minority part of musicians' income, and this actually there has been a disproportionate focus on recording sales overall. Often we're accused of being a bit pie in the sky when we say, well, actually, look at live performance, look at merchandising, there are myriad ways of actually reaching your fans. We're often accused of being a bit naive. Actually, hard, cold statistics show that that's precisely where the majority of the income for musicians comes from.
I think there's a growing frustration with consumers. I myself wrote one that you go to the store, buy a DVD, and then you own the DVD, but if you want to go away, you can never take a copy with you unless it's on a disc, which, when you have many discs, it becomes incredibly cumbersome. So there's an argument, why can't I have the legally bought DVD? Why can't I just also download a free copy to take with me? Why can't I take my favourite films away with me?
Well, this is precisely one of the key areas that we want to look at, and that giving a right to also transfer something that you've bought into different formats. Mm. I think for those of us who are a little bit older than you, I'm hugely tired about having, you know, I've been through vinyl and tapes and mini discs, and it creates this huge sense of resentment.
want. Mm. And I think this is something that the music industry is just completely failing to understand, and also the film industry is failing to understand, that the way that you're going to be able to sell things in the future is by creating a relationship with your fan base. Mm. And now I think since the advent of the internet, and particularly since the advent of social media, people are expecting a different kind of relationship. They're not just expecting to have objects thrust out of them. It's actually much more a kind of two-way conversation. And it's sites like Bandcamp, for example, are showing that possibility where musicians can upload their own material, have conversations, put out material for free, put out material for pay what you dare, and that actually begins to grow a fan base. We always say that the big problem that musicians have is not piracy, it's obscurity.
Mm. Okay. Another claim, just moving away from the main policies you've got on the site and reading down through to the manifesto, another claim was that you'd siphon off, I think it was 0.5% of government spending to large IT budgets of IT budgets of the large departments, for example, the MOD, NHS and things like that. And by doing this, you would allow free broadband for the entire country. I mean, just can you clue us in on some of the maths there?
Yes. Well, the big headline in this is that a huge amount of money is wasted on large IT projects. Whenever, for example, things like the NHS spine is mentioned, our activists who are very much part of the party who are very much involved in the technology industry always roll their eyes. What we're saying is that in this austerity-driven times is that there are some very clear savings that can be had by bringing in open source software, by bringing in free software. That also, it's incredibly frustrating because actually we have the know-how that we could bring in and that we could make very concrete savings that can actually release money, but also. That will allow for a greater openness, a different kind of way of actually operating as a government overall.
Okay. There's also a statement on the website that said that the party would allow consumers to pay for only the broadband they use, other than so instead of buying a 20 meg broadband connection, only getting 8 and just having to deal with that, you'd only pay for the 8 meg you'd receive. I think you'd receive a lot of support on that one. Is that...
Well, this is a story that comes up with tedious regularity.
Right.
It's like it feels like every 2 months where you kind of tune into BBC Breakfast or something, and you kind of have this. Do you know that you're actually getting what you think you're paying for? And it's this particularly these kind of weasel words. Well, you'll get up to.
Yeah.
And actually, what we're trying to make people aware of is that. Very few people are getting up to this, really, what they're expecting. And really the focus of governments recently has been more on the kind of advertising. But actually we're saying we've got to actually look in much more detail in terms of even what is the infrastructure that we're putting in place. Because actually so much of Britain is badly catered for as infrastructure. And there's no possible way that most ISPs can live up to these claims that they're giving.
Mm. I think many people would say that, I mean, I, for one, I'm paying for up to 20 meg. I believe I measured it the other day. I get about 6 at maximum.
Yes, exactly. And that's pretty typical. Yeah. And what's incredibly frustrating is actually most people don't have the time or energy or inclination to even check that. Mm. People just expect it. And I think that's fair enough. We can't expect everyone to kind of be going in and checking that in the same way that you wouldn't imagine to say, well, I'm going to check my electricity supply every day. You know, it's ridiculous.
One of the biggest free speech issues of our time came up before the end of last year. It was the WikiLeaks, for want of a better word, scandal. The Pirate Party, not only in the UK, but also around the world, sort of acted fast. And I think even the Swedish Pirate Party are hosting sections of the WikiLeaks website. But the party, certainly here, condemned the use, or condemned Operation Payback. Can you sort of explain
days
of what happened?
Yes,
there?
So there's a whole a slew of issues there. The first thing to say is that we have been the only party that has been consistent in our support for WikiLeaks. In fact, we're the only politicians who've dared to speak out about it. All the main parties are terrified when you mention it. I've mentioned it to MPs and prospective MPs, and they back off in horror. We think that the WikiLeaks project is vital because an informed public is vital for democracy, that openness and transparent are vital, transparency are vital for democracy. That's why we've been consistent in our support for the WikiLeaks project. And in particular, whistleblowing is a vital and important part of the democratic mechanism. If there are parts of our public life that aren't open to scrutiny, we're not saying that we're against secrets. But in that case, there are parts of our public life and things that we're paying for which aren't open to scrutiny. So therefore, we're relying on the conscience of individual people, and that's why whistleblowing is important. So that's why, as an international movement, we've also actually done something about it. We're not just a kind of opposition party who likes to make warm words but do nothing. Pirate Party Sweden is hosting some of the WikiLeaks on its servers. We, along with other pirate parties around the world, have been hosting WikiLeaks mirrors. There was particular focus on a Pirate Party Switzerland because WikiLeaks.ch is still the domain that a lot of WikiLeaks points to. It's hosted by the Swiss Pirate Party.
Yes.
So we think it's important. Now, then, Operation Payback.
For those who don't know, this is the various different hackers and bloggers who decided to try and bring down companies who'd prevented WikiLeaks. So, for example, they brought down MasterCard, Amazon, PayPal, various different websites, to try and stop free flowing of the internet, essentially.
Yes. Well, we've been always very clear that we don't think that denial of service attacks are either a useful or certainly not a useful a way of protest, and it's not something that we condone. Actually, for us, it would be inconsistent with our freedom of speech policy, and that's what we've always said, is that you don't take on your opponents by silencing them. I'm ready for a debate with anyone. That said, we share their frustration, and we've certainly communicated, because we communicated to them that we what our position was, and they've communicated back to us what their position is too. Particularly when Anonymous is a rather amorphous group of people. But what we do share is a real frustration that, for example, MasterCard cut off sending payments going through to WikiLeaks itself, and this was to us an unacceptable caving in to what was political pressure.
Yes.
And it was a very specific caving in. You can still, if you want to donate to the KKK, that racist American organisation,
yes,
get out your MasterCard. You can do it. So we can say, but we said there are other ways. To protest. And I took particular pleasure in showing my cut-up MasterCard on CNN in front of very pleasurable. But just to show that there are absolutely things that you can do which don't involve silencing others' freedom of speech.
I suppose there is an argument, though, that this sort of thing not only strikes a blow against those who want to bring down Assange, but also does raise your profile slightly. I agree it's against the freedom of speech, and it is against everything you stand for, but at the same time, it will raise your profile measurably. I mean, I don't know if you would have been on CNN if it hadn't happened, for example, to be devil's advocate.
I think it was a combination of things. What was kind of extraordinary about December was particularly how quickly that story developed and how big it was. And it also showed that actually pirate parties internationally were right at the heart of one of the most important international stories, and that we were doing something to actually bring about our policies, and also to be consistent with our policies, and that also that we're not afraid to stand up for what we believe in. And that what was extraordinary was the complete free hand, because major shows were casting around for guests, and as I say, mainstream politicians don't seem to want to touch it, and it's about time they should.
Just sort of talk about, I know you're very supportive of WikiLeaks. Are you supportive of absolutely everything they've put out, or do you think in some cases they've gone too far? You know, there are some things that some would argue, I know they would say it about everything that WikiLeaks released, but some governments would argue that it's a threat to national security, some of the things that have been released. In those cases where it may provoke, for example, if some of the documents where WikiLeaks were talking about, for example, the Palestinian papers and things, if there are very sort of secret discussions in there that are very sensitive issues, especially in the Middle East, is it something that could not prevent, you know, sort of, can you cause things
like
that?
Yes, well, we've never been uncritical. And we don't say that, you know, certainly I'm not an Assange fanboy or something like that. I mean, that would be a ridiculous position to take. But also we're saying that overall we are supportive of the project. But when it comes down to this supposed threat to national security and particularly to people's lives, what we can demonstrate that up to this point, number of lives actually directly lost thanks to Cablegate, the Iraq war papers, the Afghanistan logs, nil. Numbers of civilian lives lost, number of lives lost in Iraq, tens upon thousands, and that 15,000 victims in Iraq, civilian victims in the Iraq conflicts, were revealed. So it's far from threatening people's lives. It's showing what we are actively doing and what we are actively involved in, and what we are responsible for. As a country, we are paying for this.
Okay. Previous leader Andrew Robinson once said that the Pirate Party's chances of getting elected in the UK Parliament were close to zero due to the first-past-the-post system. Would you agree with this analysis?
At the moment, yes, but who knows? We're still in the state of building as a party.
Yes.
I suppose there's kind of various things in this, because obviously we've got the AV referendum coming up. I wonder if that's where you were going with this.
Yeah.
I'm really happy that also the party backed me in recommending a yes vote to the AV referendum. It's going to be a little upgrade that I think could make a big difference to British democracy. One of the things that's a real problem at the moment in terms of British democracy is that actually there are far too many safe seats, and really how elections are won is by getting out your core vote and making sure that that stays solid. And that goes for really most seats in this country. So it actually becomes a rather cynical process. What AV means is that it's going to be necessary for all parties to actually seek much wider in terms of getting votes. And I think I think it will have a very healthy effect of meaning that all the parties will have to rip up the rule book. There is a kind of rule book, and that's what we've kind of discovered over the last year, of actually how you win an election. It's going to rip that up, and I think that's going to have a very healthy effect on British democracy.
I think one of the ironic things about the AV, the biggest criticism, people say it will always end up with a coalition. Well, we've done that with First Past the Post. I think
well, exactly.
We seem to be struggling.
There's no, and also that even changing from one majority to a government to another, which is supposed to be the big argument for First Past the Post, actually has happened very rarely in British political history. So even the kind of claims of the No campaign actually don't hold much water. Although although I can't get terribly excited about the kind of argy-barging between the two camps, I don't think that's that interesting. I think what's interesting is saying about what do we need to do to reinvigorate people's interest in British democracy, because we can see, with yesterday, who won the Barnsley by-election? Well, it was the Apathy Party. And last night people were tweeting, oh, yeah, well, it looks like turnout's going to be over 30%. Phew, wow. It was going to be... Yeah. And it's going... That it's still shameful. Yes. It's shameful.
It's interesting you mentioned the by-election. It was something I was about to come on to. I mean, talking about particularly, you know, the removal of safe seats, AV wouldn't have had sort of any impact last night with the Labour vote being at 60%. But I think we're always going to find seats like that. There will always be safe seats unless you go to a proportional system. How do you think, sort of, in light of the Lib Dems, for those who don't know, the Lib Dems finished sixth in the by-election last night behind UKIP, the BNP, and an independent candidate who was basically a one-man army that defeated an entire party. How do you think, you know, sort of that's going to affect the Lib Dems? What do you think is going to happen to them now?
Well, they're putting a very brave face on it this morning, which is not surprising, saying, well, we didn't run a very good campaign in Barnsley, whereas, say, in Oldham, where I stood, they said, we ran a much better campaign there and it held up. I think, despite the brave face, is that there are a lot of activists who are very worried, and also they're hugely concerned. I think we're coming to the point of saying, well, what's the point of this anymore? And why are we doing this? If actually we're not getting enough out of it in terms of, or actually we're compromising on some key areas, and that I talk to Lib Dem activists and they're very antsy. I think the big effect could be actually a real falling away of that key activist support that's so vital to the kind of the functioning of a party. And also we'll see is that now, even for us, is that suddenly it's suddenly becoming clearer that the Pirate Party is actually much more, is much clearer on some of their key areas like civil liberties. Nick Clegg was supposed to be against the Digital Economy Act, but yes, we're the ones that are actually doing something by submitting to Ofcom. So I think we'll already see. I think the result is interesting for another reason, because you suddenly see that there's a growing appetite for a range of new forces in British politics of various different types.
Just to sort of follow on from that as well, you mentioned that you stood in Oldham. Do you regret not standing in Barnsley, looking at how well some of the smaller parties did last night? Would it have been good exposure for you, particularly in almost in Nick Clegg's backyard?
I think that would have been a little bit cynical, because we don't have the base there in terms of people and the ground. We're in terms of Greater Manchester, there's more obvious there. I think it's about, we have to be very clear about focusing our activity. As again, we've had a big round of work on in terms of the WikiLeaks story, and also we just had our party conference. So we took a very clear view that it was time to just sit back and build further. And after all, the Greens didn't stand either, which rather surprised me, to be honest.
Finally, just a question sort of about yourself. You know, you mentioned that we've already mentioned you're a composer, you're a lecturer at Salford University. What on earth prompted you to move into politics? I mean, I know we've vaguely touched on this already, but...
Well, I think it's something that a lot of us say in various pirate parties is that we're not politicians because we want to be. We're politicians because we have to be. Because no one is actually standing up for these key areas. For example, that the Digital Economy Act, which I touched on, this could well be affecting a lot of you coming up soon. There are threats to spy on your internet connection, to cut you off the internet, just in the name of protecting copyright. We're the only people that both get this area and they're actually willing to stand up. I think it's also purely personally, I was ashamed as a musician, frankly, when the musicians' union was pushing for this kind of legislation. That was what prompted me to be more active, as I felt this is actually completely opposite to what music is. To me, music is about communication, and I felt that we were going down completely the wrong path. And it's all very well sitting down and posting a few narky comments on Facebook, and even signing a few petitions. But actually, that's not going to do that much. About petitions, I get bombarded with this kind of stuff now. And actually, I have much more respect for people who get out there and really do something. Yes. So I'm just trying to do that in my own way and in the way that I feel that matches up with the things that I'm passionate about and need to be achieved in British politics, which no one else is doing.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Good luck to you as well. I think you've got a lot of support myself. But, OK, we'll be back in a moment. But in the meantime, thanks to Loz Kay.
Thank you very much. Thank you.